Test. Test. Is that working? Okay, thanks. Good afternoon, and thanks for joining us today. It is Friday, April 13th, 2018. It's 1 p.m., and this is the panel entitled When Women Lead, Business Succeeds. I'm Sharon Matusik. I'm the dean here at the Lead School of Business, and I'm thrilled to be moderating this panel in particular. The success of women in business is something we care a lot about at the Lead School. We have amazing faculty doing research on diversity and inclusion in the workplace. Their research has been featured at the White House and in publications like The Economist and The Wall Street Journal. So this is an area that we care a lot about at the Lead School. We also have launched an initiative last year called End the Gap by 2020. And what we're trying to do at the business school is get our female population to be 50% across all of our programs, because we believe that when women lead, businesses succeed. And there's lots of really terrific evidence around how when businesses have mixed gender leadership teams, they have better innovation performance and better financial performance. So we have a really amazing panel to talk with us today, and our goal is to provide you with some insights on the different experiences women have had in the business world and how that's contributed to the business's success. In terms of our panelists today, to my left I have Martha Clark Goss. She's a director at American Water Works, and she's had a very long and impressive career in the field of banking, investment, and finance, working for organizations such as Chase, Prudential, and as CFO at Booz Allen and Hamilton. She's also had very extensive experience working on corporate boards, both private and public boards. She's a faculty member at Deloitte University, and she was the co-honoree, along with Margaret Thatcher, for the Brown Independent Man Award in 1996, and served as a delegate to President Clinton's Economic Summit. Next to Martha, we have Lena Gutschunk. Did I say that correctly? Yes, fantastic. She's an aerialist, dancer, contortionist, actress, and entrepreneur. So she has amazing experience from the performing arts area. She is a former artist with the Moscow State Circus. She was awarded the silver medal at the European Youth Circus Festival, and she continued her training as an aerialist, dancer, contortionist, and actress at the Berlin School for the Circus in former East Berlin. She's a director, choreographer, project manager of international performing arts projects across Europe and Asia. She's a founding member of the German Circus Research and Lobby Group, Netzwerk Circus, and is the artistic supervisor at the esteemed Palazzo Gourmet Theater in Europe. And then on the end, we have Lisa Swenenson, and Ellen Spednagel, one of our students in international affairs, is going to introduce her.
Hello. Lisa is the general manager and director of Southern California Edison Carrier Solutions. Her company is a commercial telecommunications service provider whose parent company, Edison International, is ranked 235th on the Fortune 500 list. Prior to her current position, Lisa was managing director at Edison Capital, where she was responsible for the affordable housing business unit, which included commercial properties in 36 states and represented more than $1 billion in equity investment. It's been my pleasure to get to know Lisa this week, and I'd introduce her.
Thank you. And before we get started, I just want to mention that this session is underwritten by the CU Environmental Center, which is helping us to reduce the CWA's environmental impact. The center's support has enabled the CWA to purchase carbon offsets for speaker airline travel, to reduce its paper consumption, to promote our live streaming platform, and to offer free hop bus service. We encourage you to make use of these resources during your time at CWA. So what we're going to do first is have each speaker have a few opening comments. We have a few discussion questions to kick things off, and then we'll open it up for your questions from the audience. So with that, I'll let Martha kick things off.
Thank you. So I, as mentioned, I've been in the business world for more years than I'd like to count, probably about 45. I had my first true leadership role when I became treasurer of Prudential Insurance Company at 33 years old. This was in 1983. All of my peers in the industry were men in their 50s, and even my own then husband and father did not believe that I had been asked to be treasurer. They kept asking me, treasurer of what? And I'd say the company, and they'd say, well, what part of the company? And I'd say, the whole thing. And I was in that role for 6 years, and I repeated that response probably more times than I could count. So even after I'd been in the job for many years, it was always at least once a month I got the question. I was subsequently given the opportunity to become the first female investment unit head at Prudential. I ran an investment unit at the time, was in the late 80s, early 90s. We had a $7 billion portfolio of electric and gas utilities and alternative energy projects. And interestingly enough, even though that sounds like a male business, almost half of my investment professionals were women. In fact, when I was given responsibility for this unit, we were a new unit that was put together and pulled from other investment units. And I had to negotiate with the heads of the other two investment units. At one of our meetings, when we were discussing which companies were going to come into our unit, at the beginning of the discussion, one of the heads of the other investment units said to me, this was somebody who thought he should have gotten the job. He said to me, well, Martha, have you decided what you're going to name your unit? And I said, well, no, we haven't quite decided yet. And he said, well, I have an idea. Why don't you call it the LUC? And I said, well, what's that? And he said, the Ladies Utility Corps. Wow. And I said, well, you know, I think we're probably going to call it Pru Power. It kind of fits my image a lot better than that. So a little snide, but sometimes you had to be a little snide in those kind of situations. But so I was very lucky. I had a number of just really wonderful experiences in my career and was in senior positions that my boards as well. I was typically the first woman on a board. I think there's been one board where I wasn't the first woman, and I've been on about 20 boards over the last 25 years. So what I wanted to spend the rest of my time talking about is my favorite board, and the reason it's my favorite board, you'll hear, has to do with the proportion of women involved in the company and on the board. The company is American Water Works. We are the largest publicly traded water utility in the United States. We are the only company in the S&P 500 that has a female CEO and a female CFO. And up until recently, our board was 62.5% women. It's now a little closer to 50 because, as our CEO said, we needed to add a little diversity to the board. And approximately half of our senior management team are women. I don't believe there's another company in the S&P 500 that can claim that, any of those. So it's really exciting to be part of American Water. I've been on that board for almost 15 years, it's hard to believe. And it's just been a great experience, particularly seeing that the chemistry at the board is a little different than many of the other boards I serve on, for the obvious reason. Again, most of the boards that I've served on in the past, I was the first woman. Sometimes they added one or two additional women. But there's a lot of literature out there that when you have, you know, two women or three women, there's a tipping point. And I think that's partially true. But it really does change the dynamic when that's 50-50. And I would like to say that we have more than succeeded. We went IPO in 2008. At that time, our stock price was $21.50. Today, it's approximately $81. And if any of you know anything about public utilities, that's a very good increase in the stock price for public utilities. Probably more impressive is our current CEO. When she came in, the stock price was approximately $38. And she's been in her role for 4 years, almost five. And again, it's gone from 38 to the low 80s. It's been as high as 92, I believe. And it's down a little bit right now because we are a utility. And interest rates are increasing, which is always a negative for utilities because people buy us for the yield of our dividend. And because there's just concern about the utility industry at the present time. But we've had growth of our EPS of 7 to 10% a year. That's our objective. And we have met that every single year. So it's really wonderful, and it's really wonderful to see our CEO, who, again, is a female. She is an amazing leader. She's tough. She makes really tough decisions. I was with somebody the other day, one of the other panelists here at CWA, who was saying that there were several dimensions of leadership, and that the only one that women typically didn't score highest on was vision. And I thought, well, that's really interesting, because Susan, our CEO, is at least two steps ahead of everybody. And she is always thinking, and she's always pushing the company and doing both tactical and strategic things that have really allowed us to leapfrog other people in the industry. So it's just been a real joy to be on the board, and I'm very proud to say that I'm on their board and to work with Susan and our other female senior managers and other female directors, as well as the men.
Hello. It's great to see so many young women in the audience tonight, today. I'm coming from a very different field. I'm working in the arts, and I just wanted to share a little bit of what are my leadership roles in my industry, and what is my kind of everyday life, and what are the situations that I lead in. So I'm not only working as an artist, as a performer on stage, but I'm also a circus producer. So what are the things that I do? When planning a new project, one of the first things that I do is the planning and the casting, the building the team. So bringing together the different people that I'll be working on for a show that we want to create for a theater or for a client. So I'm casting this team, usually trying to think of people that I've already worked with, that I know are good team players, that I know that I like working with. I need to find a choreographer, I need to find a musical director, I need to find a costume designer, I need to find a director, I need to find artists, acrobats, I need to find musicians sometimes, who did I forget, light designer, sound designer. So it's a big team of people that I'm trying to bring together for this show. One of the first steps, of course, is to explain what is the artistic vision of the show, what is the budget. And then also, what are the restrictions of the operation? So we're doing a project in Japan, but we only have 3 days in the actual theater to put on a 30-minute show, and the artists are coming from 3 different continents. We have a production in France, we have a production in Montreal, Canada, and we have a local team in Japan that already starts. So that is usually my first step of bringing the team together and trying to make everyone responsible for it and trying to find solutions for the restrictions together so that everybody in this team feels ownership over the project as well. Next steps would be production and creation. That means bringing all of these different teams together, being in the same place or being at different places at the same time, and trying to make a show. And then the last part is usually operations, keeping the show running, making sure that no one gets hurt, not too many fights, and to react to changes when changes need to be done. I wanted to talk a little bit about what sometimes the issues are that I'm dealing with, and that I'm trying to solve in these different steps. I was talking already about how to build the team, and I think that's one of my most important things, how to bring the team together, but then also already during the creation. Because I work with so many creative people, I usually face that we make a show together, but the costume designer thinks that the most important thing in the show are the costumes. The music designer thinks the most important thing is the music. The director, of course, thinks, of course, the most important thing is the scenes that we put together. The artists think that most important is their rehearsal time, so that they can be safe and shine on stage. So it's managing these, all of these. It's mainly emotions, actually. trying to manage that, and what I'm doing is I try to make everyone excited about what the other people bring to the project. So I'm trying to have a director that is excited about a choreographer coming in and making their scenes not only make sense from a playful, from like the scene point of view, but also make it look good with the entire team and with the artist. To make a costume designer excited about a musical director that together with the music, these costumes will actually look what you imagine them to look like on stage. So that is one of the main parts that I'm trying to give everyone a responsibility, but also see what the other people bring to the same project. During creations, we have very unstable schedules because we're changing the show every single day. So the schedules are very unstable, but we always have a very fixed deadline that can never be changed because it's premiere and we've already sold tickets. So another very important thing for me is communication, to make sure that everybody who's working on the team always knows where we are in the project. Are we still working on this scene, or did we already kick it out of the show? I don't want a costume designer who is in their studio still making that one costume for a scene that actually this morning got cut. So it's all of these frustrations that could come up if not everybody's informed of what's going on. So communications is, I think, one of my key things that I'm thinking about when working with these kind of teams. During the show run, once the premiere is done, I mainly deal with the artists and everybody who's still responsible for the everyday show run. So most of the time, the creators, the directors, the costume designers have left, but we have still the show operators, the light sound people, we have all of the artists, we have the stage manager, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm kind of approaching it in the same way that I do with building the teams. Whereas I'm hoping that everybody feels ownership over the show. So I feel me as a leader, I'm doing a good job if everybody wants to make the show better every single day. And I'm doing a really bad job if I'm the only one trying to fix the show and everybody else is just constantly complaining about we have more and more rehearsals too that are unpaid rehearsals. So what I try to do is really make everyone feel a part of the show and know that they can give creative input into where they think that the show could be better, give them ownership over their ideas, make them feel that their ideas are heard. And at the same time, I'm trying to give them responsibility in the sense that I have dealt with a lot of artists that are frustrated because they don't like the scene, or they think that they don't look good in this scene, or they think that the light in this particular act does not serve what the show should need. And what I usually try to do is I'm asking people not to complain, but I'm asking them what they think the solution to this problem is. And that already sometimes switches a little bit for them to understand, to go into the perspective of, okay, I'm trying to find a solution for this. I'm trying to make them think about, okay, what does that indicate? Who do we need for rehearsals for this? Is it really worth trying to make this change or not? And just to give them the ownership over this part. So this is a little bit an overview of what my everyday life is when I'm leading these kind of projects. But before I came on this panel, and I hope, I don't know if my time is already up, but I asked my student ambassador what she would be interested in hearing, actually. And she said that she would be interested in hearing how I got to lead, actually. And I was thinking about this because it was not something that I came up when I was in high school and I decided I want to be a leading woman in the arts. Quite the opposite. I started as an artist because I loved the arts, and it actually came out of frustration. We had a situation in a show where we had a tragic accident in the show, and we were there with a whole cast of artists. It was not one show got canceled when the accident happened, and then there was the discussion: do we carry on the next day? Can we go on stage? And I just felt like the whole team of artists were not ready to go on stage yet. I felt like there was no leadership from the theater side to really step in and deciding what is the next step to do and what is the right thing to do. And I was so frustrated and I was so emotionally involved in this as well. And for me, it was kind of a little bit of a tipping point because I was speaking to my boyfriend on the phone and I was complaining that there's no one there who really takes the lead in this and no one there who takes the responsibility for this. And I was complaining the whole time, and then he just said, "Lena, maybe you just have to do it." And I had no real arguments why not, because I was just seeing this lack in leadership, and it frustrated me, and I was afraid of what the other people, the other artists, my peers would think if I would step forward and try to lead this. But I made the decision that maybe I can speak with them and I can start this process. And actually what I realized is that my experience showed me that people actually want to have someone who's leading, simply because it's so much easier if someone just says, how about this direction, to find your own position into this. So if I'm saying maybe we should go to the left, all of a sudden everybody knows, do I like to go to the left or would I rather go to the right? And then we can have a discussion. But if no one is saying, let's go to the left or to the right or straight, everybody's just floating around in the room. So for me, this was really a tipping point of, okay, maybe I could be this person, and maybe there's people who would support me in doing that and would be willing to follow or to challenge me as well at the same time. I know I think I've already talked for a long time, but I just wanted to close with two little more things, because that was only the ignite little bit for me to start thinking about leadership. The next two steps that I had was learning from others. I seeked out to learn a lot about show business and how shows are done, and I didn't really just want to see it from the artist's point of view. I wanted to understand, how does marketing work? I went to talk to marketing directors of the theaters that I worked with to understand, how do they market circus shows? I went to talk to salespeople. How do you sell tickets? How do you make ticket prices? I went to talk to light designers. I wanted to understand what their view on the show is that they see every single day. I went to talk to directors, all kinds of people in different organizations, just to learn their perspectives, because one thing I learned is important in leadership is that you always have to solve a problem with all kinds of people, and they all have different perspectives on that problem. And you can't just look at one problem and solve it from your perspective, but you always have to keep everyone else in mind. So I learned a lot from these people. And the last step for me was to find coaches and mentors. And that came from just seeking out and asking and learning from other people that I started to find people who would want to support me in learning more and giving me responsibility. And I had two people in my life that really helped me with this. One was my boyfriend, who was running a business that he knew that he would not be able to run full time anymore, so he needed someone to step in, which was very fortunate for me, because I learned a lot of leadership and project management skills from him. And the other one was a woman in a theater that I'm working with since 7 years now, who was the new artistic director, and who I had really interesting conversations with, because I'm stealing this from you, Lisa, I think, because you mentioned it in your mentorship panel just this morning. We had what did you say? I need to look it up. I think you said something like we cared about the same things.
Common values.
We had common values, and we cared about the same things in the show. So she was someone who started to listen to my perspectives and who started to give me a lot more responsibility, which I'm super grateful of. But this is just like the overall view of like finding the spark of why you would want to be leading, learning from other people, and then seeking out and finding coaches and mentors that can help you get more responsibility or help you get into positions where you get the chance to lead. Thank you.
So, first of all, I am so grateful to be here. What a great university. I've had a lot of good questions that have been asked. It is my last panel, but I've been so grateful to be on them. I have learned so much from the panelists. I've learned so much from people coming, asking questions, so I love to learn. So leadership is about continuing to learn, so that's one thing I want to share. I saw the title and I struggled. So when I saw the title, When Women Lead, Businesses Succeed. But then I got some data from Martha. I found out, look what happened to the stock price. Look what she learned from her view. So all this data that I'm getting along the way, and I'm sure somebody's done some research, I have never worked with a female in the C-suite. Okay, so the highest level of the executive leadership has always been male. I've been in corporate America. It's more male-dominated industries, banking, real estate, investment, and telecom. So I've learned a lot from those leaders. Some have been successful, some have not. So I was very much like Lena, to be honest, is I did not seek out to be a leader. I actually went to school to become an attorney and decided I didn't want to go to law school, and what am I going to do? So I took a base level accounting job, which, by the way, I got a C in accounting. So I thought, how do I do this? So I just figured it out. And I found that I learned by doing. I worked real hard on those, you know, get those, that coursework done and try to get decent grades, but I learned by doing. So experience is key. I've met a lot of people who've had a lot of, you know, great academics, but then they come into the workplace and they kind of struggle because they keep trying to find the answer in the book. So I think Lena really called out the answer is in real life. You've got to solve problems. So I started my career doing, you know, kind of doing things to have a job and build experience. I think foundational, if I can encourage you to do anything, wherever you work, learn the core of the business. Learn why the business is there. So if they got rid of everybody, who would they keep? So I always use the Apple analogy. You'd keep Wozniak and Steve Jobs. Wozniak engineered it. Steve Jobs told him how he wanted it engineered, and he sold it. So that's the core. So even if you want to go into HR, even if you want to lead in different areas of finance and things of that nature, please know the core as a leader. So the core of hers is to put on productions, right? The water company, things of that nature. So why are we in business? So as a leader, and I'll kind of jump to where I am, but I did the same thing. I kind of solved problems and got so frustrated that I had to just kind of come in and jump and solve a few problems. And then somebody tapped on my shoulder and said, can you lead this team? And I said, oh, no. I don't want to manage. I like my individual projects, and I want to have a beginning and an end, and I don't want to deal with people issues. And that's basically what I said. I was working with people, and I said, I have a big family. I know a lot of those people issues, so I think maybe not. But I ended up doing it, and it ended up being very rewarding. So I've done it probably since I was 32, 58 now, so I've been doing it a long time. But I will say that what started for me was wanting to solve problems. And then what I realized is having some pretty tough leaders that I didn't agree with, not some of the best examples, I learned how that impacted work environments. So when you go, I think the first thing you got to remember as a leader is why are we here? What is our goal? So that's the one thing when I talk, quite frankly, to women, including my two girls, but mostly my youngest daughter, who's 26 and she's in project management at Aerospace, is I literally will ask the question. I'll give you an example, and I gave it before, so you heard it, I'm sorry. She worked in an apparel company that does golf apparel. And she had a representative who she'd take the call, she would help get these projects through. And they kept having to make the shirts over and over because they did the logos wrong. It was for a university, and the logos were wrong, and it was for the golf team, so it was kind of a big deal. And she said to me, I go, Sarah, why is your business in business? She goes, to sell apparel. And I said, no, it's to make money. And if you do the order four times, you're not making money. So kind of giving that lens, and that's where I see women miss it. And I know that Martha can agree because someone that I just thought was awesome was a CFO at our companies, now at hers, really said, get some financial literacy, right? First and foremost, how do you make money? How do you lose money? You know it because you literally have a budget at home that you're trying to manage, and when you run a little short, you have to work a little more, you have to call mom and dad, whatever those solutions are. When you're in business, you're not going to be in business very long. So for leadership, what I try to do is start with know what the business is about and how you're going to do it. Second, it's about the people. So that's my view. Everybody can have a different view on it, but good work gets done through good people that are engaged. And when you create an environment that's hostile and you're working for somebody who is unethical or doesn't care about the people, only cares about profits, doesn't care about you as the whole person that's showing up, then those people stay as long as they have to get the skills to get somewhere else. And you don't want to lose top talent. So you want to go in an environment, and sometimes you're in an environment where you're getting great skills, and I've done that, but I'm going to get out because I don't like where the tone at the top is what they call it. What's the tone of the top? What was the tone of the top at Enron? There's a comment for you. Go do a study on that, right? So what I would say to you is figure out, really, when you bring the people in, I expect certain level of values to be, and she talked about it, what are the values? Well, I know the values of my company, and it aligns with me. Those are only words and a piece of paper, though. So you have to spend time listening. So everything that she brought up, I run a team, so I'll give you an example of a typical meeting. I come in, and I've got all the teams reporting into me. It's telecommunication, and there's a lot of tension in telecommunication. So everybody in here wants fastest speeds, and you want to download that video right away, and you don't want to wait, and you're so tired of saying, I've run out of data, right? So what my company is, an infrastructure company. We have fiber optic cables throughout the LA Metro. We have antennas up on our towers. So I manage a commercial business that really moves a lot of the traffic for the carriers. So when someone comes in and they want us to pull fiber to towers so that you can get as much data on those cell phones as you'd like, as soon as you want it, we have a customer on the other side that says, get it done quick. We need that tower right away. Well, I'm building in the LA Metro. So if anybody feels comfortable about your streets being ripped up and parking control and field crews out there, you don't like it. So it's complicated to build. It takes time. So a sales guy will say, we can do that and we'll get it to you quick. Then I bring it in. The engineer said, no way. You don't have enough data. This is a terrible project. You guys don't know what you're talking about on the front line. So then all of a sudden the engineers are freaking out. And then the pricing guys are going, I need it. I have to price right away. Then we've got to do contracts. So everything you talk about, everybody has a different view, and it's everybody else's fault. So that's the bottom line. So as a leader, you have to pull them in and be able to listen and confront the brutal facts, which comes from good to great. You've got to lean into those conversations. So as a leader, if you go hide in there and just hope that they could fight it out, you've created a pretty hostile work environment. You've gotten people very frustrated. So just as she said, the show has to go on. There was a tragic injury. What can I do? She said, okay, what do you need to do? When you're going to left, you want to go right. What are the things you need to do? So those are some of the things that I would say. As a leader, get to know your people, but also we all show up differently. We all run into personal issues. We all come from different backgrounds. I have often had the situation where women are not comfortable kind of presenting and or even leading kind of more male-dominated, strong personality meetings, right? And so welcome to transmission and distribution at Edison. It's field crews, and then it's the leaders over all the field crews delivering a very dangerous product, electricity. People get killed. I've gone to funerals. I've gone to hospitals. It's a dangerous business. So it's a serious business. But women can be successful there. So that's the one thing women don't realize. Go in there. You have something to offer, but you better learn the business. You better know what they're trying to solve, how they're trying to solve it. So what I would say is, don't shy away from the core. Know what the core of the business is. Try to work in the core for a period of time. Even if your passion is law, your passion is HR, understand the core of the business. You'll be a much better leader no matter where you are. And the other is to listening, trying to understand the dynamics, being fluid. Finally, be vulnerable. I do not have all the answers. You guys all have a cell phone that could probably find more information than I can find in 2 seconds, right? You can get it right away. So don't try to be the smartest person in the room. Don't try to be that person that's a subject matter expert that shuts everybody down. In my world, they're called intellectual bullies. I'll just be frank with you. They want you to look stupid, so you'll be quiet, right? Don't tolerate that, right? So lean in, get your information, and have something to offer, offer it. So be vulnerable. Look for feedback. Let people, and I heard it on the last panel, which was just phenomenal, he'd go and say, hey, what could I have done a little bit better on that, you know, on that project? Okay, what went well? Really put them in a position to give you the feedback without, you know, them feeling bad about doing it. So, you know, vulnerability, continue to learn. I mean, those are all the guiding principles. I think you heard quite a great deal, obviously, from the other panelists. But the key is that's the one thing I will say when we talk about when business, you know, when women are in leadership roles, know the core. Why is the business, and they got rid of everybody. If they had to get rid of everybody but, you know, 20 people, who would stay? That's your core. And then understand how the company makes money, how they lose money, what are the challenges they face inside the company and externally. So hopefully that gives you a little bit of lens about how I approach it. I also focus on building sustainable businesses, so it's more thoughtful and measured. I have worked for companies, so it's get rich quick. That's probably not me, so that might be some, you know, folks want to get real, you know, get some money quick. I'm more about kind of building the teams and the infrastructure and the systems, so a more measured and thoughtful approach for a sustainable business over the long term. So that's my approach. So thank you, and thank you. I learned a lot, took a lot of notes. So.
So
in terms of one question to kick us off, you're all very highly successful leaders in your own field. Can you talk about one important challenge you faced as a leader and how you persevered?
I have so many, so yeah, I'm just trying to sort through which one would be the best. I can go. I was over at the portfolio. I was very passionate about working in affordable housing. So I started in commercial real estate, and I kind of got a little bit not motivated maybe to build high-end luxury housing and high-end office buildings. So I literally wanted to switch to affordable housing and do something in the community. So that was a passion of mine. I did exactly what she said. I sought up everybody that could teach me about that business. Where does the money come from? What is the expectation? Who's watching over it? So I learned everything about what makes affordable housing projects, which are like apartments. In fact, Edison invested quite a bit in lower downtown Denver. So we've been all over the country, the chamber building, buildings like that. So I was so passionate, so I learned everything I could so that I could be in that business. So I tell you, I felt like a subject matter expert. I'm just going to be quite frank. I felt like a subject matter expert. The bosses that I reported into when I ran the business pretty much made me feel like I was. They didn't ask a lot of questions. Then I got a boss who was all about pedigree. So what you may hear this once in a while, but pedigree is the right degree from the right school and the right experience. So that's defined differently, but by my boss, it was a top-tier business school. It was having an MBA, also from a top-tier. Definitely having an undergrad for this particular business. It's not for everything, but by the way, he managed engineering teams. Housing doesn't need an engineer. So I'm just going to tell you, you have civil, but overall you don't need an engineer to run it. It's not like you're running an electric utility. But he wanted you to have an engineering degree of some sort. So for 2 solid years, he dissected me. So I had been running this portfolio. It had been successful, and I call it a very destructive Socratic method. He'd ask me every single question he could to try to set me up and show my gaps in my knowledge. When I had teams that reported into me, he'd say, well, no, I don't want to know how, you know, Robbie, who was doing the work, I don't want to know his view on that financial model. Did you do the financial model? And I went, I haven't done a financial model in a while, but that's exactly what happened. It's as if I had to prove myself all over again. So very tough leaders. Could he find some gaps? Yes. Overall, I think in a couple years, he accepted his confidence that even though I went to Washington State and I was a poli sci and degree and minor in economics, that maybe I did know the business and I could run the business, and we actually worked very well the second 2 years, but it was painful because his view was that. Now, what did I learn about that leader? He was pretty bitter. He had all these degrees. He felt he should run the company. And the reason he wasn't running the company is because of those people skills, mm-hmm. right? So people did not want to work for him. And the more they don't, you know, the more he wasn't moving, the angrier he got, and it comes out in his leadership. So he wasn't allowing himself to be vulnerable. He wasn't allowing himself to learn from others and change. And so there was lessons on both sides, and he didn't care. That's the way he was very successful. But what I would say to you is to really have to prove myself over and over again was pretty exhausting. And it helped me as a leader. I will not ever do that to somebody that reports into me. I will not do that. So people learn better when they're not stressed out and they're challenged and just assume they don't know it. They learn better when you can kind of take them offline and help them work through things. So that's the way I approach it. So that was my experience. Thank you.
Either of you want to comment on that?
So my biggest challenges, frankly, I've had many in my own business career, but my biggest challenges have been when I've been on my boards. I've been chair of, 4 audit committees. That's always one that a lot of controversies get brought before the audit committee. And I've had 2 in particular that were very, very challenging. Typically when you're on a board, particularly today, things have changed in the governance side, but particularly today, you're re-elected every year. And under the Sarbanes-Oxley regulations that came in the early 2000s, the role or the influence of the CEO theoretically is less than it used to be. It used to be the CEO chose whoever was going to be on the board. You know, if he wanted so-and-so on the board, they were on the board, and if he didn't want them on the board, they weren't on the board. And Sarbox has changed that a lot in terms of structurally, but still there's a fair amount of influence from the CEO as to who gets on the board. I had one CEO that I was working with who was not happy because I occasionally said no, and I said no on some very important things. And so he tried to change the committee chairs. He tried to change the committee chairs. He also tried to get me off the board. I luckily had a lot of support from the chair. We had an independent chair and a separate CEO. Again, another change that's come through Sarbox. And the chair was very supportive of me, and I had to go to him and say, look, I feel very strongly that I don't agree with what he's doing. And the chair said, "That's I agree with you." He said, stick to your guns. I did, and I outlasted the CEO. Mm-hmm. I outlasted two CEOs who tried to fight me and try to get me off the board. But it was a matter of principle for me. You know, these were things that mm-hmm. were my role in the board is to do what's the right thing for the shareholders and for the other stakeholders in the company. And if you feel the CEO is overstepping his bounds or her bounds, you know, hopefully you can work it out between you and the CEO or the board and the CEO. But if you can't, you have to take a stand. And as chair of the audit committee, that's often the case. That's what your role is.
Yeah, I was thinking about what kind of challenge I was facing. I think because I'm working as a freelancer, I'm able to just avoid situations like this. But of course, that's not always the case. And I was thinking about. I think whenever I faced a situation like this, I was trying to find partners that would fight this fight with me. Mm-hmm. So, for example. My business partner and my fiancé, James, who's also a speaker in this conference, we do circus productions in Japan together. But these productions, he started the production company way before I came into the game. And we had new clients, and we knew that these clients wanted to speak with him about the budget, about the initial projects. They didn't really know what the artist is doing there. So my partner was the one who had the MBA. He was the one who had the first connection to the people. He was the one who was a male. But we already felt this, and instead of just saying, okay, but this cannot be right. I want to be the one leading this thing. I should be the one. We should teach them that this is wrong, and I'm just going in without you, and I'm doing the deal. We decided, you know what? Maybe they're just not ready for this yet, and maybe we can do it step by step. Maybe we just go in together. Maybe you're the one talking. I'm just silent. Maybe we just have the first meeting like this. You introduce me. Maybe we have the second meeting, and you already ask my opinion on a couple of things because you say that I'm the expert on these kind of specific show-related things, for example. And we went on like this over and over again until we were at a point where it was no problem for me to be the only one going to Japan leading the project. So I think that sometimes it's really just like finding mm-hmm. finding the right allies with you to fight this fight. And sometimes it just doesn't change from one day to the next, but sometimes we also need to educate the people. And if they just see it, and if they just see it step by step and not just confronted with, now you have to deal with a woman, even though you have no idea how to do business with a woman because you've never done it, I think that just helped me a lot in my little career, to have people that just help me fight this fight a little bit.
And thank you for the questions that are coming in. So you can either use the app, and it'll pop up here, or note cards are fine. So there's a few different themes associated with some of the questions. So let me, and of course we give priority to the student questions, so if you're a student, please indicate that. One student question is, do you owe your success to a calculated life path, or just saying yes to the opportunities in front of you? Also, do you consider luck as playing a role in your success? Do you consider luck as playing an important role in your success?
Absolutely.
Great question.
I always love it when, you know, you're going through an interview and they say, so where do you expect to be in 5 or 10 years? Mm-hmm. That's a great question, but it really is not a very useful question. Mm-hmm. I found that most of my career, I had opportunities presented to me that often did not appear to be opportunities. Mm-hmm. I had a personal situation early in my career. My husband, when I was first married, we found out very shortly after we were married that he had cancer, and he had to be treated in Washington, D.C., and I was working in New York. So I had to give up. I'd worked for a year and a half, and I loved my career, and I had to give up my, I thought I was going to have to give up my entire career. I was working for Chase, and my boss at Chase stuck his neck out, and he found me a job in Washington. It wasn't, you know, of the caliber of the work that I was doing in New York, but it was what I had to do. So as a result, I was postponed. I was on a fast track, but I was postponed on my first promotion, and it was quite upsetting to me. But when I came back, I was given an opportunity to take a job that wouldn't have been available the year before, and it gave me a tremendous opportunity to learn a whole different area of banking, and was frankly the basis of a career that eventually was where I went into the insurance company and the investment side. So it was a detour, at least I felt it was a detour. I then had an opportunity to take I was recruited by a headhunter to take a really very powerful job. I had a 30 or 40% increase in compensation, but I was also looking at going to business school. And so I said to the headhunter, I said, you know, I just got accepted to business school. Should I go to business school or shall I take this job? And I give her a lot of credit, she said, because she, you know, she was going to get a big commission. She said, I think you ought to go to business school. And this was back in 1976, and there weren't too many women going to business school in those days. And I went to Harvard, and there were very few women going to Harvard at that point. So again, it was sort of another detour that I hadn't planned, but it kind of was the right fit. The biggest one of those was when I eventually went to Prudential. I went back to Chase after business school, but then I was recruited to go to Prudential. And in those days, bankers looked down on insurance companies. And all of my friends at Prudential or at Chase, including my boss, said, you're going to work for an insurance company? Are you kidding? And I got all sorts of flack about that. That was the best career decision I ever made. And once I was at Pru for about a year and a half, they asked me to become treasurer. And as I say, that really propelled my career. And at the time when I was asked to be treasurer, the treasurer's job at Prudential was considered a backwater. And I really debated it. It was like a glorified cash management job. And it was like, is this what I really want to do with my job or with my career? But because I liked my boss, or the fellow who offered me the opportunity, I said, what the heck, I'll give it a try. And as a result, I was able to get involved. It was a real pivot point for Prudential in terms of the way they finance their operations. And as a result, I was involved in several hundreds of millions of dollars of Eurobond financing at a time when that was just really getting to be what insurance companies were doing. I was promoted twice in the job. My compensation tripled in 6 years. And it was probably the best career decision I ever made, but it was a totally serendipitous and rather risky decision. But I knew what I was good at, and I think that's what it comes down to. You have to know what you're good at. And if you think you're good at something, and you think this is a good opportunity, and you see something that other people don't see, it's probably worth the risk. And I'm a risk taker. I know that. I've always been a risk taker. And I, you know, maybe occasionally take the wrong risk, but I think it's important for you to think that you have to take the path that is the right path for you, not the tried and true path that everybody else does. If you feel that you've got the ability to do something different and you can make something of it.
Either of you want to comment on that? I still don't have a 5-year plan. I never really had, and I hated that question. Is it good? Is it bad? I don't really know. I mean, there's both sides to it. I'm absolutely up for say yes to when you see opportunities, but they don't just come. Like you also have to be open and look for them. And that for me worked when I know what I'm interested in. I know what I want to learn, and I think that life is kind of constant learning. There's always something else that you haven't discovered yet and that is interesting to you, then go out there, seek people that know something about it and ask them what you can learn from them, and maybe they have something that you can, maybe you can be of help to them. Maybe they have a project where they just need someone to be there, and you can watch them and you can learn from them. Not having a plan, though, sometimes also it definitely forces you to sometimes stop and think about where you want to go and what you want to do and where your values are, what you want to do, what you're interested in. I think I'm sometimes wishing I had a plan, because there's times, of course, in my life where I'm like, I feel lost because I don't really know what the next step is. And then I can listen and maybe they find something that I'm interested in. But sometimes it takes sometimes time to also find what you're interested in or what's the next thing that's kind of grabbing you and where you wanna go next. So I think if you have the plan and you know roughly where you wanna go, that can help you to overcome these moments where you don't know what this next step should be for you, and you can just follow that, but still make sure that you stop and listen sometimes to see, oh, maybe I should change my 5-year plan.
So as I said, when I was 8 years old, I thought I wanted to be an attorney. So I kind of went through college with that. So when I graduated, I needed to have a job. It wasn't calculated. It was like, where could I get a job? I'd worked at a law firm as a file clerk and had an opportunity to go in and work with the in-house CPA, really as an accounting clerk. But I actually had a crazy opportunity to work on an accounting patent. So what happened is it was a patent case where someone had invented Streskin panel and was being cheated out of royalties. So it was an accounting patent case. This was rather fascinating. I ended up just entering data and looking at invoices, but getting to work around attorneys, which is when I decided I thought the law was great, but I thought for me it was a little too narrow. I liked the wider view of the whole business, so I changed paths. So what I would say is I kind of went down this path of saying, here's the job I'm doing today, do it well because I need to get a paycheck and I need to get a decent review and I don't want to get fired, right? So those are kind of some of the things you just do practically. But as you go along, you need to go out there and think about building skills, experience, and figuring out the way the world works. And then at the same time, you start to get introduced to industries. One of the things that I think kind of surprises me sometimes is someone just thought, I just want to only be in IT, or I just want to only do HR, or I only want to work in this specific industry. But life happens. And as we can see, things are going to change at a rapid pace. So staying in kind of looking at what's going on in the world. This is a great conference. It's good to see students here at these meetings. Kind of getting a sense of what's going on in the world. What's the future of work? Where are my aptitudes? Where are my skill sets? And then build on those. And then, yes, luck plays a part. So I have two things that were very lucky, and they're very tough. It was the real estate crisis in the 1990s, and then again it was the energy crisis in early 2000 in California. So both of those led to a path where I got some amazing work that I got to do at Kenneth Leventhal. And we worked all over the world. I did not work on the Trump engagement, but we had top partners working on that engagement, and I have mixed feelings about them helping him get where he is today. But anyway, you can all have your feelings there. But the bottom line is that was a very big engagement. But we work with all the real estate companies. That happened by luck, which a lot of people considered a lot of bad luck, but I got all this good experience. So when you see the problems that are surfacing around you, can you help solve them, learn about them, and find your way through? The next thing you have is experience. You're sitting in an interview and you could say, here's what happened. I didn't plan this, but I landed in this. And we as leaders look for people that leaned into those problems, that looked and really jumped in and learned something they weren't comfortable with. So you look for people that are resilient, work through adversity, not afraid to learn new stuff, always thinking about how to add value, and obviously have good values. So you can't get that unless those situations provide it, or you're kind of looking for it. And so the other was the energy crisis when everything changed and I ended up taking over that portfolio of $1 billion of investment in affordable housing. So I went into the leadership role there during that change. So those are the kind of things that, yes, some of it's luck, some of it's right timing, but my favorite movie is Hidden Figures around this. Be ready. So when the timing presents itself, when they're having issues and they need someone to come in and actually do the numbers, right, she was ready. The same as they were ready when the machines came in, of how to run the machines. There are so many good examples. I really have not seen a book or a movie that gave better examples about building your skills, being ready, and changing. So you might have been a computer before, where you were computing, but that went to a machine. What are we looking at today? A lot of things going to machines. So what do we want to think about? So those are the things I would say on your journey, the experiences, the skills, but keep learning and keeping a wider lens on it. So
we have a couple of questions along the theme of what specific skills or values does a woman leader bring to the job that makes her company more successful?
Well, I think that, again, I'll use our CEO at American Water. She's a great example. Brilliant woman. She's a nuclear engineer by background. She's had a tremendously successful career before she ever came to American Water. But the thing that I respect most about her is that she's asked questions, she pushes people, she challenges them, but she keeps her ego in check. And that is such a huge issue. And I think the women leaders that I've had experience with, I mean, you have to have some sort of ego to be a CEO, trust me, because you wouldn't survive if you didn't have one. But I think the women CEOs that I've either worked with or know or have had experience with have an ability to keep their ego in check and still lead. And it allows them to be much more open to hearing other people's ideas and incorporating them and complimenting and giving people credit for their ideas. And as a result, the people who work for them just love it, because they're given credit. They can challenge the leader, and the leader is not intimidated by being challenged. And in many cases, again, the ones that I know are pretty good at saying, "Oh, okay, I hadn't thought about it that way. Let's try that." And I think that's a huge lesson for any leader, male or female. But I think that's probably the biggest thing that I've seen in successful female leaders.
I had exactly the same thought, actually, because for me, leadership is kind of the opposite of someone being egoistic, because leadership means that you have to have so many people in mind when you make decisions, and there's so many people that you want to follow your decision, and that doesn't work if you don't have their opinions in mind and if you don't know where they are right now and where they want to go, where they need to go, or what they need. And without giving credit to them, they don't feel ownership over where you're going. So for me, it's really this thing. I don't know if it's something that women do better than men. I think that there's really great male leaders out there who have the same ability. But for me, it's just something that's very big in leadership, to not have a big ego.
So that's the other thing, that kind of your luck is sometimes your bad luck. I was lucky I'm lucky to be a female and move into male-dominated worlds, and then I was unlucky to be a female and be in, you know, male-dominated worlds. And the reason that is because when you go through experiences of feeling dismissed, not valued, like you don't belong at the table, you get the comments, inappropriate at time, people try to kind of harass you out, are you part of the boys' club or not? No, I'm not. I'm not going to fit in there, and I don't want to. Therefore, you've developed empathy and understanding. So I got all those experiences helped me become a more empathetic and understanding leader so that I could work across a more diverse population. I could understand when I saw someone, you know, sitting in the back of the room, a woman, and she's not comfortable coming up to the table because she's intimidated, and grab her and have her come sit with me. I could do the same thing with a male that I see that's in the back of the room and not feeling comfortable because of their personality isn't so big, and they're not comfortable because it's such, you know, they're more introverted, and maybe they're an engineer and in a role that they're not comfortable, and help them kind of be a part of that conversation. So what I would say is I'm very lucky. And I know when sometimes tough things happen to you and you're felt like an outsider, you're made fun of, jokes are made, as hard as that is, you're building more empathy than most of us. And so I don't have all the stories to say that I've had a lot of tough times. Some of it's a lot subtler. But I do know what it feels like. I do know what to look for. I do know what to pay attention to because I've had those experiences. So I think in my particular woman in kind of corporate America, not mostly dominated by white heterosexual males, let's be honest, I have really had the opportunity to know what it feels like and how to work through those so that I can help others. So I think that's one thing that's kind of unique to women in business. And again, we can kind of pull more people in, especially people that don't speak up a lot. We know how to pull them in to that conversation. So that's key.
So a few questions from women who are very young in their careers, so they're undergraduates here. Can you talk a little bit about either classes you would recommend they take or early experiences they should seek out if they want to move into leadership roles as they finish their education and move into business?
I'll go to something Lisa has said on a number of occasions. Learn the business. So take an accounting course, even if you don't like don't think you want to be an accountant. I think an accounting course is the basic building block to be able to understand a company and how it works. So if you have an opportunity, and frankly, when I was in college, it was in the late 60s, early 70s, and the school I went to did not offer an accounting course. And that was a real loss for me. Luckily, I went to work at Chase in their credit training program, and they taught a three-week immersion accounting course that was a one-year college credit in 3 weeks. And I was so glad to have that opportunity. So the earlier you have the opportunity to take an accounting course and to understand the basics of the business and how the balance sheet and the income statement, cash flow statements all work together, the better off you're going to be. And then you can take it from there. I think there are lots of other courses that you could take, corporate finance or HR administration or whatever, but a basic accounting course is probably the best building block you can have if you're serious about being in business.
So, thank you. I have a lot of things, so maybe if you have a pen, I'll tell you a few, which I tell all folks that work for me, but often women. The book called The Goal by Goldratt. He's a physicist, and I can't remember, but pretty bright guy. I think the book was written in 1985, and it's been handed to me several times recently. My girls, who both work in project management in an aerospace firm, it was just recommended to them. Mind you, I told all my kids to read it 5 years ago, but when somebody else tells them, then they're going to read it. So the goal is great. It's how businesses run, how they make money, and how they fail. So it kind of gets into all that. The other is Khan Academy is great, and it's K-H-A-N. If you haven't heard of it, you will find finance. You'll find accounting. Another one I thought about as I was just sitting here is Small Business for Dummies. Go look at the Accounting for Dummies, Finance Tip for Dummies. You don't have to become an expert, but you have to understand it. So those are all things. And this is where I will tell you, I was in a leadership program where senior leaders across the state of California were going different places. And I sat next to a woman who's high up as an executive in a leadership role, and they kept talking about P&L, P&L. And she leaned over to me and said, what's a P&L? And it's profit and loss. It's how your company makes money. Not knowing what a P&L is going to hurt you because you're not knowing the core business. You're not knowing how they make money or lose money. So it is not rocket science. So spend some time on it. You should know it anyway because you're going to manage, your 401ks. You're going to look at your own budget. So everyone should have some knowledge there. And so those are the things. Other than that is having conversations with, get to know people that you really feel that you can be heard, both men and women. You really need to mentor with men as well. You need to mentor with people that have different personalities. If you're an extrovert, mentor with introverts. That's really the beauty of kind of understanding how you work and how different people think and do things. So it'll help you when you go into the workplace. Why don't they get it? It's just common sense. It's common sense for you, for your background, but it may not be for them. There's cultural differences. So I would just simply say have those conversations. Your friends, your family, and if you're in workplaces now, you see it all. You see those differences. So there's just a lot of opportunity, but I would say I'd read The Goal, following up, kind of learning more about accounting and how businesses make money and lose it. I also think the Steve Jobs book is good. I'm not a fan of his leadership, but it kind of tells you how he built a company, how he got fired from his company. So, I mean, it's everything. So why he failed as a leader, and then how he came back as a leader. So it's actually pretty good on leadership and business and all the things I talked to before. So those are the couple.
I would just want to add, because I know that some universities offer leadership programs. My partner James has had a great experience with that. But if your university does not offer these kind of things, and I never went to college actually myself, but there's lots of online courses out there on different kind of businesses. I had to laugh a little bit when you mentioned accounting, because it was one of the first courses that I took when I wanted to learn about business.
Yes.
One of the platforms is Coursera.org. They have lots of it's Coursera.org. They have actually professors from leading universities giving online courses that you can learn. There's also courses about leadership in there. I'm not recalling the title right now, but if you search for leadership, you'll find them there. And there are programs that not only give you videos that teach you things about it, but they also give you the opportunity to connect with peers, with other people that are also taking the course. You have you're assigned to a certain task that you then exchange with other people from around the world. So it's a really great opportunity to learn about leadership and to learn about business skills with other people from really different places in the world.
Early in your careers, how did you deal with ageism in the workplace? And today, how do you deal with sexism in the workplace?
The first part?
Early in your career, did you have to deal with age discrimination, meaning you seemed young and inexperienced in the workplace, and today do you experience sexism in the workplace?
I'm chuckling because I dealt with sexism first and then ageism.
I guess it works on both ends.
That's right.
I guess it works on both ends.
I mean, I'm at a point that typically people don't get invited on boards after about 63 years old, and I am 69. So ageism is definitely an issue. But, and it's an issue, what I've discovered, it's an issue with with publicly held companies. I have had other invitations subsequent to that for privately held companies. And in fact, it's worked out fine because I have really good experience in publicly traded companies that the private companies really appreciate, and they don't have as much problem with ageism. The sexism part, my favorite story on that front was my first job at Chase. There, we discovered it was a training program, and it was a wonderful training program. But we discovered that there was a fellow from my college, the same college I'd gone to, who had a lower grade point average than I did, and he didn't do as well in the training program. And then there was a woman who went to a college that was comparable to a male college that another colleague of ours had gone to. Same thing. She had done much better in the credit course. She had better grades in college, et cetera. And we all compared salaries, which, of course, in those days was completely not approved of. And so we decided, the four of us, that we were going to go to the HR department and say, you know, what's the deal here? Now, the difference was only $500, but we were making $9,000 a year, and $500 was a lot of money. So we went to the HR department. We thought we were really smart doing this. And they said, the head of HR met with us, and he said, well, the difference is, in the case of my situation and my compatriot, he played sports. And
wow.
I said, really? And in the case of the other woman and her counterpart, well, so the male had submitted his dissertation from college. And she said, well, I would have submitted mine. I have one, too. Do you want me to submit it? No, I don't really want to see that. So they refused to do anything at that point. But the next time we had our, and again, because it was a training class, we were kind of in lockstep. The next time they did raises for everybody, we all got evened out. So they wouldn't acknowledge it, but they did make up within 6 months. They kind of made it up. And subsequent to that, they did not differentiate unless there was a difference between being an undergraduate or an MBA coming into the program. And that makes sense, because obviously an MBA has a much greater knowledge and experience of the business world than those of us who came in as liberal arts majors. But that was probably the biggest one. The second one was that in the same training program, I had a boss who was very excited about, he said, you know, would you like to be a division leader in the credit department, meaning a management job and also training? And I said, oh, yeah, I would love to do that. And he came back to me a week later, and he said, I have to rescind this offer because we're afraid that there are some men in the program who couldn't work for you. And I said, you've got to be kidding me. That's their problem. But I did not get promoted to that job. Subsequently, I got promoted to a better job, but this is back in the 70s. This is 1971, 72, and there certainly was a lot more of it, and it was more overt. I am not going to say that it isn't around anymore. It's still around, but it's much more subtle.
Sexism and ageism. I think I'll just give one example. I was working at my prior company, and I was trying to get something out of accounts payable, and there was this young lady, she's probably 21 years old, she was in college, and she worked as an accounts payable. And I kept sending her an email, and I'd leave a voicemail trying to figure out if we paid this company, and she'd never respond, and I got so annoyed. And finally somebody said, I am her. So there's instant messaging and this tool that you can use. And I said, that is just messing around at work. That is not real work. So I was so annoyed. You know, this new technology was coming out, and I'm ignoring it because I thought it was like, back then it was MySpace and instant messaging, and that's what my kids do. That's just playing around at work. And they go, no, she'll answer you. And it was remarkable. So that's me kind of doing it in the reverse, right? So I said, hey, did we get this client paid? And in a second, she responded. And I went, okay, shame on me, right? So you're bringing this new technology in the way you do it, and in a way, I'm kind of like, you do it my way. I'm going to leave you a voicemail, which got completely ignored, or I'm going to send you an email. So those are kind of the insights around sexism. I guess I would say, yes, it's there in different situations. I think it's also more, just to be really clear on some of the things that I saw, I didn't see it as so much so egregious, but I think you kind of hit on it, Martha, is people are comfortable working with people that are like them. I mean, I'm just going to say that. That's kind of what happens. And what they miss out is the growing, the learning, and that diversity can bring. Okay, I just gave you an example where I didn't want her to do the communication, and I am. I'm comfortable working with people that'll do an email because that's how I work. So you're kind of forcing people to change sometimes when they just want to do it the way they've done it. So if they're looking at four or five people right in front of them that they've trained and they know how they do it, it's really hard to bring somebody in from the outside that's going to challenge the way they see work getting done. It doesn't feel as safe. It doesn't feel as comfortable. So those things are changing, but I can tell you my organization, I've sat on diverse panels, and the idea was you have a diverse panel for diverse perspective. But the person that was hiring was constantly nudging towards a specific candidate. And so if my ratings were a little higher, they would challenge them so that the other person in there who worked for them would know, okay, I know where my boss is leaning. So that, you see what I mean? There's the subtleness of those things happening. So I don't always think it's intentional that people are trying to discriminate or whatever. I just think sometimes you got to remember it's just comfortable. So I'm not going to go to a football game with a bunch of people from Fresno State because I love Boise State. It's not comfortable to sit with them, right? So what I would say, I'm going to go where I'm comfortable and be around people. But that's changing. But you've got to really pay attention. Those things do go on. And find out how you can be prepared, just like on Hidden Figures, that you have to be in the room, even though it's not comfortable with them. So I think those are the kind of couple ways that I look at it, just from my perspective of that new technology, which, by the way, I like me today, but I didn't like it at the time.
Could I, let me tell one other story, too. At one point, I was the only female in a group of investment heads. I was head of this investment unit, and there were four other guys who were head of their respective investment units. And we were having a meeting of the group, and there was a woman in one of the other investment units who had just had a baby, and she was coming back, and there was an opportunity for her. And the guy who was her boss brought it up, and he said, gosh, I mean, she'd be great for that job, but I don't want to put her in a position where she'd have to turn it down because maybe since she's had the baby, she doesn't want to travel or she doesn't want to do this or that. And this is a lot more recent. This was in the mid-90s. And I'm the only woman sitting in the room, and I said, wait a minute, why didn't you give her the opportunity to make that decision? If you think she's the best person for the job, give her the chance. She can always say no. Well, I don't want to put her in that position. Now, they would never have said that about a guy, and it just burned me up, and they did not offer her the job. I was really, really upset.
So, I mean, those are the realities. They're not pleasant, but they're out there, right? So just know that kind of going in to pay attention to it. So don't want to be discouraging, but know that those things are going on, but they're also going on in some ways. People think they're doing the right thing.
Right.
I think I'm just not going to put her in that position, or, you know, I'm just comfortable with this team. They wouldn't be comfortable on my team. Those are some things I think. Yeah. It's not always ill intention. It's just sometimes life.
So we have about 3 minutes left. A couple of themes that I heard come out loud and clear, which I thought would be useful to recap. You know, in terms of personal advice, some of the themes I hear from this panel are the importance of listening, the importance of always learning, the importance of taking risks, and really understanding where value comes from and what role you can play in that. In terms of some of the things that allow organizations to really succeed because of women, the theme that I heard coming out loud and clear was around humility, inclusion, and empathy. I'm going to make one announcement, and then I'm going to ask the panelists to close out with one word in terms of one quality that you each think was most important in terms of your success as a leader. So let me read my announcement, so I'll give you a minute to collect your thoughts on that. So this evening, there's a special event taking place at 4 p.m. CWA is hosting its 70th celebration party on the Hill. There'll be free food from Hill restaurants and live music. This event is open to everyone, so please join us at 4 p.m. at the new Hill Event Street on the corner of 13th and Pennsylvania. So who wants to go first? You have a one-word answer.
Well, it's not going to be one word. I would say it's lifelong learning and always being open to new ideas, new technologies, and new people.
I'm trying to find one word for that, and I think it's curiosity.
Vulnerability.
Please join me in thanking this panel.